Good evening and welcome to the Thursday evening in-depth Bible class of the Trillicoochee Church of Christ. We are studying the subject, what does the Bible teach about the nature of God? This is the third lesson. And if you're following along in the notes, we are on the second page, letter G. We've gotten as far as the characteristic of holiness of God, and that's where we'll begin this evening. The holiness of God. We have been talking about His attributes, and one of the things I suggested as we began this study is to mark the ones that are either limited to God alone or those that He has shared with us when He created us or those that we will receive whenever we are in our glorified form in the presence of God in heaven. And so as we go through these, be certain to make those marks. When we get to the last few lessons, we will discuss which ones fall into what category. In His holiness, this characteristic says that God is completely separate from sin and wholly incorruptible. Now, there are two different things. In being completely separate from sin, what this is saying is that it is so alien to His nature that He and sin cannot coexist in the same place, which should suggest to us that was why humankind was separated from God when Adam and Eve sinned. And when a human being chooses to engage in sin today, it provides a barrier or a separation that God cannot cross. He cannot be in contact with or in fellowship with sin, so He is completely separate from it. And the second aspect is He is wholly or fully incorruptible. God cannot be tempted, and there can be no sin if temptation doesn't occur. Remember our formula when we studied the book of James a couple of years ago. Our formula was that desire plus opportunity equals temptation. One has to have the desire, and one also has to have the opportunity to engage the desire. And when both of those exist, then temptation occurs. Temptation is not sin, but temptation plus action, engaging the temptation, equals sin. So that's the formulas that you see in James 1. Well, James also tells us that God cannot be tempted. It's just not possible for Him. God cannot lie. He cannot sin. Someone might say, well, is anything impossible for God? Yes. God cannot be tempted by sin. Therefore, He will not commit sin. In the prophets that you see, both in the Old Testament as well as in the New Testament, Isaiah in the Old, John in the New, both of them portray a throne room scene. And in the throne room scene, the praise that's given to God is holy, holy, holy. This is called the Trihagios, or the triple holy. And the Trihagios is the pronunciation of the holiness of God. Let's understand how this works. I think this is really intriguing to know how they spoke in the past. Think about the matter of peace. When you read in Jewish literature or in the Old Testament scriptures a word repeated twice, what does that mean? It is the perfected form of the word. You know, there is a passage in one of the prophets that says, "He shall be kept in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on God." In Hebrew, it's written this way, "He shall be kept in peace, peace, whose mind is stayed on God." So to repeat a word twice is to elevate it to its perfected form or complete form. But only repeating a word three times can be applied to deity. So you could say, holy, holy. The holiest of holies was part of the tabernacle, later part of the temple. The holiest of holies was the place where God came. It was the holiest place on the earth, at least as far as human beings could reckon. And so God would meet at the mercy seat in the holiest of holies, the high priest who would come in there with offerings. And so that's the holiest of holies. But only God can it be said of him that he is holy, holy, a third time holy. So this is holiness elevated beyond its completed or perfected form. It is holiness reserved only for deity. And I find that very interesting. So in Isaiah 6 and Revelation 4, do you find this trihagios, or the triple holy, used of God? I also found it intriguing that in the Aramaic version of the Old Testament, not the Septuagint, which is what they used in the quoted in the New Testament, but in the Aramaic version of the Old Testament, the trihagios in Isaiah is repeated three times. And so as you would read it, they're praising God and saying he is holy, 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 holy. So three times they, and really there is no way in human speech to overstate this characteristic of God. And while we might understand from the New Testament that God's defining characteristic is love, nowhere in scriptures does it say that God is love, 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 or that God is power, power, power. It is only this one characteristic of God that is elevated to the triple level. And I find that fascinating in describing this characteristic of God. It helps us to understand that when we are in our sin has created a barrier that God cannot cross. He provided the means of erasing that barrier through Jesus Christ, the sacrifice. Any discussion on this one before moving on? And it would really help if you did. Doug?
Trihagios. Why is how did that word come about?
Hagios. I think hagios is the Greek form of the Hebrew word holy. H-A-G-I-O-S is the English version of the Greek word, and it means holy. Actually, what it means is set apart. The hagios is the one, that which is set apart. So to say that God is holy, 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 in Koine Greek, it would be hagios, hagios, hagios. Set apart, set apart, set apart. That's the word. Anything else? Okay, the next characteristic is God's eminence. Immanence is not a word we use often. It's kind of like the first one we used, his aseity. We don't use the word immanence very much, but what it refers to is God's presence in this world. Now, God's presence in this world is certainly not manifested in a physical form, although God did choose forms in the Old Testament to manifest or express himself. Recall when he spoke to Moses, when Moses was Jethro's helper when it came to being herdsman. How did God speak to Moses on that occasion? Yes, he spoke by means of a burning bush. He spoke as a sapphire form, a sapphire platform in the book of Exodus, whenever you find that Moses and the elders step into the presence of the divine. There were other ways that God manifested himself and spoke in the Old Testament. But God does not take physical form in this world. When God took physical form in this world, it was God the Son in the form of Jesus Christ. Immanence means that God, however the fact that he doesn't manifest in physical form, he is present in this world. And we need to recognize that this is the case. And I want to say here that we will contrast this with his transcendence, which means he's not a part of this world. But that will come later on. The psalmist writes, Jill, read that for me. Psalm 114, 5 to 8.
What ails you, O sea, that you fled? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O little hills, like rams? Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of waters.
And what the psalmist is doing is praising praising Jehovah for, specifically at the end, giving water to the people of Israel when they were in the dry regions. Water came from the rock, and then water came as a fountain from the flint rock. What we see here is he's praising God because he knows that God brought these things to pass. We could have read any number of things near the end of the book of Job where God asked Job questions, where were you when I did this? And all of the activities he lists there have to do with this world, whether the sky or the sea or the land. So God is present and God impacts and affects this world. He simply does not physically manifest himself because in his full unrevealed or unconcealed form, it would destroy the world. There is God's immutability. That is, God cannot change. And that's hard for us to understand. Because in our world, as we grow, we change. Our viewpoints evolve. The things that we believe change. As we learn more and grow in our understanding, we mature in our spirit, and the things we think that are important later in life were not important to us when we were younger. And the things we fretted over when we were young seem to be less important or unimportant as we age. We evolve and we change. It's the nature of life in this world. God does not change. James explains it in 1 and 17, says that with God there is no variation or shadow of turning. And I like James' reference here. He's actually talking about a sundial. You can tell that the day is passing if you look at a sundial because the shadow of the point on the dial moves as the sun passes across in the sky. With God, there is no change at all. And James uses a rather interesting metaphor to illustrate this. In Hebrews 6, Sandy, Hebrews 6, 17 and 18, the Hebrew writer makes it very clear to us that God's promises and his word, like his nature, doesn't change.
Hebrews 6, 17 and 18. In the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we have taken refuge would have a strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us.
So it is God's unchangeable or immutable nature that means that we can have every confidence in what he has said. Our part in the matter is the only variable. God's promise isn't going to change, and there's no chance that he will ever break it. And so that's what the Hebrew writer wants us to understand, that it is God's immutable nature that gives us the confidence in the promises that he's made. Impassibility. This one was a little tricky, and I'll explain why in just a moment. Impassibility means the inability of God to suffer. And while that was the way it was defined in the dictionary, it doesn't really apply to God unless you modify it a little bit. And that is, God has the power to decide what he will allow to affect him. So God can choose what he will allow to infect him, to affect him. So we recognize that God has emotions, and more on that as we continue through the characteristics. While we recognize that he has emotions, God is in full and complete control over himself. And not just in the sense that he controls his emotions, but he also controls what he will allow himself to emote, to feel. And so it is that he has the capacity to feel sorrow for those who are in pain, for those who are suffering, for the human condition. He has the capacity to feel sorry for those who have left him, like Israel did from time to time. But then again, he also has the capacity to feel angry, to choose to feel angry toward them when they persist, and not to be disturbed at all when they cry out. It is not something we tend to think of, but God chooses what it is that he will permit himself to experience or feel. And this is especially true in the case of those who have become reprobate. God chooses to let them go on their way. Now, we ourselves, our hearts would be torn when someone has so abandoned the faith that there's no chance that they're going to return. But God allows them to go. Doug, you hit your hand up.
Is that what he did when he wanted to destroy the world by flood, but he saw Noah and his family, and he spared them?
Well, in fact, he uses the language in Genesis 6. He uses the language that it is made him sorry that he made man, if you look at that text. And so it's not that God regretted creating humankind, but that he was sorry at what humankind came to be. And we could talk about that for the rest of the class period, but the impassibility of God means that he decides what he will allow himself to suffer or endure. The psalmist writes in 138 and 6, though the Lord is on high, yet he regards the lowly, but the proud he knows from afar. That's a rather poetic way of saying that he looks down at those who are in hardship, and he pays attention and he's concerned for their well-being. But for those who are proud, they're kept at a distance. And I think this speaks to his attachment to them. He chooses. Isaiah 57 and 15. Pat, either read from the
book. The high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the hearts of the contrite ones.
So here he has chosen to link himself or engage himself in the condition of those who are in difficulty, especially those in difficulty who are being humble and those who are regretting the things that they've done wrong and harmed the relationship with God. This is an interesting characteristic, and it's one that I think of all the ones we've looked at this evening may challenge us the most. To try to understand how it is that we can say that a loving God can choose what he will permit himself to feel about others regarding their condition. Yes?
I think that this is perhaps less difficult to comprehend if we look at the lens of atheism and the pagan world, because those gods were just a bunch of emotional wackos. I mean, to put it in modern parlance, we read the Greek myths and the Roman gods, and then the Egyptian tales of Isis and Osiris and all these things. It's nuts. I mean, they were just blown by their emotions to and fro, worse than human beings in so many ways. So, a god that chooses what he will feel and how is completely set above that. And so when you compare it to that kind of theology,
Yeah.
Then it becomes clear that this is something that human beings couldn't invent. Because when human beings invented gods, they were like us or worse.
They created their gods in their own image.
Right.
And that's especially true with regard to the Greek gods. The Romans were copyists. You know, they were borrowers. But you can look at nearly any series or pantheon. Look at the Vishnu line that you would find in Southeast Asia. Look at the Odin and Loki crowd that you would find in the Northern Europe. They're all created in the image of the people who worship them, were reflections of human nature. In fact, in many cases, not the best parts of it either. But here you find the divine has set the standard for us. And I think you're right in the sense that it's more understandable if we accept the fact that this is love at its most maturely possible level, its greatest level, and that is to understand the difference between those who need it and truly know who needs it versus those who do not need it or those who have made themselves unworthy of it. And God is the one who can make those discernments. We are not. I suspect that one day, and you might write this on your paper, one day we'll have that same capacity when we share in the divine nature, but not in this world. Okay. The next attribute is impeccability. This is closely related to God's holiness. It means that He cannot sin, and we read this earlier. Use this passage from James 1 and 13 that God cannot be tempted with evil and He does not tempt anyone. Incorporeality. Incorporeality refers to God being a spirit. What is the problem of material world bias? What problem do we as human beings tend to have in terms of bias, where spirit and material is concerned? We tend to think what? If it's material, it's more real. Right? That's the way we tend to think. If it is physical, if it can be manifested physically, then it's more real. I've got news for most folks that the materials of which this is made up, even material things like this podium here, I would not be an exaggeration to say that 99.999% of it is space. And that space is being maintained by forces we can't see with the human eye. The electromagnetic forces 1 and 2, but we're certain this is real because it's solid and we can touch it and we can encounter it. We're kind of like the blind Hindus in encountering the elephant for the first time. We have limited ability to discern. The New Testament makes it clear that the spiritual realm is not only far greater; it is far more powerful and substantial than the material realm. And that's a New Testament fact. Doug?
A stronger deal of dark matter in the universe, telling us that what we see is not the full universe.
Yes. And that it is a very small percentage when compared to it. And even dark matter is a small percentage. Dark energy is even the largest substance that, wrong word, but the largest thing existing in our universe. So the bottom line here is that we have material bias. We believe that the physical realm is more real and more solid than the spiritual realm. The New Testament makes it clear that the spiritual realm is far greater, far more powerful, and more substantial than our own. John records the words of Jesus in John 4 and 24, God is spirit, those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. It is not possible to represent spirit with flesh. Point of fact, our physical bodies are only going to exist for a limited period of time in this world. But from the moment that we are conceived, we become a living being, we become a living soul that cannot die. We have a body that will, but we tend to think of our spirit, our soul, as being less substantial than our body. It's a material world bias. The reality is that our spirit is greater than our body, for it will outlast it for eternity. We will never end. Well, when we pass from this life, our body goes to the ground, our disembodied spirit goes to the waiting place of the dead till the day of judgment, when we are reincorporated. We receive a corporeal form, but it is an heavenly form, a form that our spirit can exist in eternally. And likewise, those who are evil, they get a form that can exist in perdition forever. The bottom line here is that the spiritual world is more powerful and more substantial. You can't represent it with flesh. Exodus 20:4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. When Solomon finished building the temple, an enormous sum of money and multiple years of work, not only on his part, but David began collecting materials for it long before Solomon worked on it. And Solomon, when he finished it after that magnificent task, did all the sacrifices to dedicate it, stepped back, brushed his hands, and made an observation about it. Anybody remember what Solomon said? This house is too small for God. I'm paraphrasing. Solomon said, this house can't contain the glory of God. He's the guy who built it, the first and the greatest of the temples. And when he was done, he looked at it and realized, this house is small and pitiful to hold the glory of God. That's why they were commanded not to create any structure to represent God. Because any structure they build to represent God is going to do what? Aside from lead them astray, it's going to fall short in many ways. God's incomprehensibility. And that means that it is not possible for humans in this world to know God in the fullness of His wisdom. There are some things God has chosen not to reveal to humankind. And it's because we are not capable of grasping those things now. But then in the New Testament, as John points out in 1 John 3, that we will know as we are known. We will know who we are as God knows us. We will understand things that we really can't understand in this realm. God has revealed enough to us, and we think that it's not fair, we'd like more information, but God has revealed enough to us to fully enable us to respond to His Word and His instructions and to live a fulfilled and faithful life. More than that would provide a source of temptation or confusion. We simply cannot embrace infinity in this world. Somebody describe infinity for me and use an illustration. I would like to hear an illustration of infinity. Katrina, you would probably come up with a good one.
Infinity.
Go ahead.
When I teach my students about infinity in general, we're talking about a number line, and we say, okay, if we go to the right on the number line, we start at zero, we have one, we have two, we have three. We can always think of another one that comes beyond, so we never get to the end.
Yes. In fact, there's a documentary on Netflix about 2 hours long about infinity. Fascinating treatment of the subject. But they talked about such things as infinity to the infinite degree. I mean, it was all kinds of interesting concepts that I should have had a headache when I was done watching that. It was really interesting stuff. But you know what the problem with the number line is? It is a material depiction of something that cannot be depicted materially. It doesn't matter what you use. Katrina.
You might even say that infinity is something that ever expanding. concept, but suddenly you find yourself back at the beginning.
You used
because
a word.
It's constantly moving.
My point is you can't describe it.
Right.
Without using a material term. You said expanding. You know where expanding only works? In this universe. And I'm not poking fun at you. I just knew you couldn't do it. I wasn't mean about that. But infinity is not something that can be grasped by the human mind. When I was in Bible class as a young fellow, probably in my early teens, maybe 10 or 11 years, 12 years old or something like that, David Brewer was the Bible class teacher, and he had a wonderful illustration, and I kept that picture in my mind ever since then. He said, imagine a steel ball bearing the size of the earth. And he said, picture a bird that can fly forever, and he makes a circle around the earth. And every time he gets to the same point, he makes a little dip and touches his wing to that ball bearing. He says, when that ball bearing wears down to a grain of sand, that will be infinity. I thought, that's a pretty good illustration. The problem is, it's still using material things to describe something that cannot be described materially in a material realm. God is infinite, and it's not possible for us to grasp or understand all of his divine characteristics, especially this particular one. When God reveals himself, we take that revelation and realize that much more is implied about this. One of the things that David meditated on in the book of Psalms. Louis Berkhof wrote regarding this characteristic of God. He writes, insofar as God reveals himself in his attributes, we have some knowledge of his divine being. Though even so, our knowledge is subject to human limitations. When we read about heaven in the book of Revelation, what terms are used to describe it? Things that are treasured in this realm, but will not exist in that realm. At least not in a material form. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. Doug, please.
My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. And my thoughts than your thoughts.
Thank you. And what the prophet here is doing, he's speaking on behalf of Jehovah, explaining that the way we think is not the way that God thinks. And that the distance between our reasoning and God's reasoning and our knowledge and God's knowledge is a gap that cannot be bridged in this realm. That is God's incomprehensibility. Closely related to this is that God is infinite. Now, we're not talking about his knowledge here. We're talking about his character. And this would also involve such things as his eternal nature. His eternal nature is infinite. God did not have a beginning. He has always been. He is, and he will always be. And again, that's not something that in this realm we can grasp very well. But God did not have beginning, nor will he have end. Or when we talk about his power, his power is infinite. There is nothing God cannot do. The further out we look into the universe, as our capacity to do so increases, the more wonders that we see. The things that were mistakenly called quasars when I was in junior high school are not quasars at all. What they are supermassive black holes that consume and expend the entire power that will be generated by a star or a sun, our sun, in its full existence every 4 minutes. Can you imagine something using so much power that it uses all of the energy a sun could contain and burns it in 4 minutes? That's huge. I mean, our minds can't get around that. The numbers that describe the size of this universe God created to place this little dust speck of an earth in are hard for us to understand even when using material terms. But then the prophet Isaiah says he holds it all in the span of his hand. And I think that Isaiah is using material terms to describe something that cannot be described in a material world. Infinite. In 1 Kings 8 and 27, "But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain you." This whole universe is not big enough to contain God. How much less this temple which I have built. Remember what I was saying about Solomon? This is not a good enough house for God. Here he's saying, you know, God, the whole universe isn't big enough to hold God. I am not going to read this passage, Katrina. You are.
Isaiah 40, beginning with verse 8. "The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in balance? Who has directed the spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket."
Stop for a moment. Isaiah asked a remarkable question, and it's one that we should meditate on before we go to bed tonight. And he asked the question here, who instructed God in justice? Who gave God knowledge? Who taught God how to understand with what's going on? Who does God use for his counselor? Those are remarkable questions. This speaks to, and it's not in this list, but this speaks to God's characteristic, his being the first cause. He is the first cause in all things. No one taught God. No one instructed him. God is all-knowing because that is his nature as God. He has all this knowledge. No one gave it to him. No one taught it to him. The characteristic that we need to understand most, and we'll get to it, but not tonight, is that God's love. God loves first. Every love a human being has is derivative. We either learned it from our parents, learned it from one another, or altruistically learned it from God. God loved as a first cause, without being instructed to love or learning love from someone else. We need to understand this nature of God. This is special when Isaiah asks these questions. Meditate on them. Please continue.
Picking up again at verse 15. "Behold, the nations are as a drop in the bucket and are counted as the small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing. To whom then will you liken me, or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name. By the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one is missing. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable."
We're just not going to get it in this world, his infinite nature. Another thing that Isaiah says in this passage that stands out is that when it talks about the stars midway through, it says that he brings out their host by number and he calls them all by name. At our best estimate, with as far as we can see with the instruments that we currently have, the number of stars in the universe, estimated number of stars in the universe, compared to the number of human beings. How many stars do you think are out there?
Innumerable.
For every human being, right now, the estimate is 2 million stars for every human being currently alive in this world. And Isaiah says he's got names for all of them. This speaks to the infinite nature of the mind of God. It's unbelievable. He knows all of them because he made all of them.
Doug.
He also knows the number of hairs on every human being ever born.
You know, that's not something that we as human beings know. Depending on your origin, where you know, what part of the world you're from, if you are light-haired or red-haired, the number of your hairs will be anywhere from 90 to 105,000. If you are brunette, your hair numbers will be anywhere from 100,000 to 120,000. And if you're like most of us men, that number is rapidly dropping every day. And as that number changes every day, I have no idea how many I've got left or how much longer I'll have the hair up on top of my head. Both my grandfathers lost their hair in their older age. But at any rate, the point I'm making is we don't know. And yet God knows at any given moment in our lives how many we have on our heads. All 7.8 billion people.
Well, I have lost considerably amount of what I used to have in my head.
TMI. TMI. Too much information. Yeah, we're all getting to that point. Solomon was lamenting old age in the 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes. I'm beginning to understand what he meant. All right, we have infinite. Let's do his invisibility. I don't want to go much further than this. Let's do his invisibility and then call it a night. And this is that God's total nature, as he is, pardon me, his spiritual being, in its fullness, is never going to be seen by humankind in this realm. So what God does is he manifests himself through visible and created things. We saw that in the Old Testament with God speaking to Moses through the burning bush. God spoke to humankind in various ways in the Old Testament, the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. He spoke in various means. He used visions on occasions, or he would use things that would be seen and would catch them by surprise. He used an animal that Balaam was riding and made the animal speak. You know, this is God manifesting his word and his will various ways. In throughout the Old and New Testament scriptures, his specific will was delivered by means of the Holy Spirit to the prophets and the Bible writers. And so he's manifesting himself in this world through visible or created things. Let's look at some of the passages. In John 1 and 18, no one has seen God at any time. This is in John's introduction to the Christ. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. So Jesus, who is now with the Father, came as God with us, as Matthew points out in Matthew chapter 1, he says that he manifested the Father to us. When they asked Jesus, show us the Father, and he says, Philip, have you been with me so long that you haven't seen it? You see me, you've seen the Father. God would manifest himself in these manners. In John 6 and 46, not that anyone has seen the Father except he who is from God. He has seen the Father, and Jesus is referring to himself. Paul praises God in the early part of the book of 1 Timothy to the young preacher. He says, now to the King eternal, immortal, invisible, to God who alone is wise, and so forth. At the end of the book, he says it again, who alone has immortality, dwelling in unapproachable life, in our form. We cannot approach the presence of God in his unveiled nature. So human beings are not going to be able to see him in this world. And that's the way of it. We're going to accept that that is the case. But he shows himself through visible created things. I'm going to mark that spot as our beginning point. Number two under O. But I have an illustration I want to do before we close. Raise your hand if you've ever read the book, Mr. A Square of Flatland. as a book I recommend. And what it's designed to do is to give us an understanding of how that a material world can coexist with a spiritual realm. And while the material world is limited, the spiritual realm is not. We are three-dimensional beings. What do I mean by three-dimensional? We have
height, width, depth.
Height, width, and depth. That's the three dimensions of our existence. Now I want you to imagine, if you will, a one-dimensional world. A world with only two dimensions. Width and depth. No height. And anyone who exists in this realm only experiences things in a depth or a width. They cannot discern height above or below. They're not capable of discerning it. So if they can only see in this direction or this direction and absolutely cannot see in this direction, how would someone in this world encounter my pen? How would he perceive it?
There would be no ability to perceive the pen.
Well, if the pen is on his plane,
it'd be a point.
He would discern this pen as a point. And that would be the only way he could discern this pen. Or if this pen penetrated his realm, now how does he see the pen?
As a circle.
He sees it as a circle. And that's all he can discern. We live in a material realm. A world that is physical in nature. We do not have the capacity in our current form to discern the spiritual realm. Those places in Scripture where God manifested himself in the word, in this world, whether by his creation and development of the world in which we live, or by his expression of himself in the book that he gave to us to read. These are the places where God has manifested himself in our realm. And if that's all we think that God is, it's because we can't see his realm. He's invisible. And so we have to accept by faith when he tells us that I'm impacting your world on this little point. You can't discern all of it. You're only capable of seeing the point where I touch. You have to believe that the rest of it exists, just like Mr. A Square of Flatland has to believe that the pen exists, even though it's only impacting his world in a single point. And that's kind of the way we need to see the spiritual realm. We need to see it as something we're not going to discern. But the evidence of God's impact in this world is sufficient to allow us to believe that that exists beyond our senses. Any questions or comments? Doug?
It's interesting to note that when Moses saw a part of God, he was in the cleft of the rocks, and we're left with the knowledge that had he seen the face of God, he would kill him.
Sure. God covered up Moses as he passed by. And just the witnessing of God as he's going away, cleft in the cleft of the rock with himself covered up by God, left him glowing. His face, his body shone from having been in the presence of God for a period after that. So that's a powerful impact. Yeah, he didn't want them seeing that the implication that the passing of that glow might suggest the passing of the glory of God or the passing of the law prematurely. Okay, thank you so much for being involved in the class and doing the reading for me and for the good comments.